You're listening to Snap Judgment. Storytelling with the beat. Stay tuned. Snap Judgment is supported by Penguin Random House Audio. What kind of listener are you? Do you like to multitask while plugged into your headphones? You see, audiobooks make the perfect companion for your daily commute, your family road trip, your chores, whatever it is you do. TryAudiobooks.com is a great resource for all your listening needs, featuring recommendations for crafters, runners, gardeners, cooks, more. Go ahead, visit TryAudiobooks.com and download a free audiobook today. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Crash and Burn. My name is Glenn Washington. Buckle up, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to start off today's Crash and Burn episode back, way back to the Berkeley of the 1970s. You know, it was the late days of America's Cultural Revolution. Young people everywhere experimenting with alternative ways to live fuller, more peaceful lives. And because of that, this story does mention substances that may or may not have been legalized depending on where you live. But Dale just wanted to climb rocks. And he wanted to do it in Yosemite Valley.
When I used to climb there and do hard routes, I used to walk up to the rock and smell it. The wind and the smell of the pine needles, I can't even describe it.
Dale Bard, first and foremost, was a rock climber. It was the 1970s, and the sport was still very young. Historically, mountaineers rock climbed as a way to practice for larger peaks they wanted to get up. So if you think climbing up rocks for the sake of climbing up rocks seems silly, back then people thought it was totally absurd.
At the time, probably there was 50 rock climbers in the United States. People recognized my talents, told me I should go to Yosemite Valley. I quit college to my parents' disbelief. Left with no money and hitchhike up to Yosemite Valley with a tent, my climbing equipment, and almost no food, an insulite pad, and a sleeping bag. Oh, I did have a pillow. I forgot. Yes.
The valley is defined by smooth granite cliffs that reach thousands of feet up from the valley floor. At the base of these cliffs, tucked back in the forest at a place called Camp 4, Dale found his people.
And that's when I got involved in the scene.
A handful of climbers had set up a permanent camp. These climbers were some of the first climbers in the country, and they would later become legendary for their climbing achievements. But at the time, they were just some dudes in the woods that loved climbing rocks.
A day in Camp 4 was not really a day in Camp 4 because we really didn't spend much time in camp. We would go climbing all day. So train, climb, train, relax, go to sleep. My annual budget 1 year was negative $15.
How did you pay? Like, how did you have no money? Like, how did you...
We had connections in things. You know, we had friends in places, and sometimes I'd be given food. We did pilfer from the local grocery store every once in a while, but it wasn't a lot, but it was enough to get by.
Living like this, seeking out the free food, sometimes stealing a little on the side when necessary, these guys got this life down to a science. And for a little while, the Rangers look the other way. That is, until the riot.
In the 70s, there was a riot in Stoneman Meadow. And it's a very famous one.
Some hippie kids were camped illegally in a place called Stoneman Meadow. When the Rangers came out on horseback to break up the crowd, the kids pulled the Rangers off their horses, and chaos ensued.
When that happened, and it happened with, you know, hippies and people that smoked dope, with that, the Rangers had to change their whole style because it's the U.S. government, and they had to be able to control a situation like that. And so they created a department called LEO, which stands for Law Enforcement Officer. So in other words, they created a police force. And the camaraderie between the climbers and the Rangers diminished pretty rapidly. We called them pine pigs. How we felt at the time, this isn't your park, it's our park. All they wanted to do is drive around in cars with, you know, 45 caliber guns on their hips. We actually appreciated the park and used it the way it was supposed to be used.
After Stoneman Meadow, the climbers kept doing exactly what they'd always done. Until one morning when Dale went to the lodge for his morning cup of free coffee. And the Rangers decided it was time to teach the climbers a lesson.
We had learned some tricks. We get free cups of coffee and possibly eat off of people's plates that left and left their plates to be, you know, bust into garbage. I just came in one morning and kind of groggy. As I'm walking over, I look over at a table and I see this coffee cup. Put my finger through the handle and walked over to the table. And I never even made it that far. And a security guard came up to me and, you know, just said, that wasn't your coffee cup. And I'm looking at him going, okay, come on, you're kidding, right?
The officer was not kidding. They cuffed Dale on the spot and threw him in county jail for a week. He was stripped and put in a delousing tank. The bigger guys in his cell stole his sleeping pad and his pillow, and Dale slept on the concrete floor.
I had a very sobering experience, I will say that. Finally, I get shackled and put in back of a van again and driven back up to Yosemite for the trial.
The judge looks incredulous.
And he goes, you spent a week in jail for a cup of coffee? So he dismissed the charges.
But even though Dale was free from prison, the Park Service still wanted to make an example of him. So they handed down maybe the worst punishment they could think of.
They suspended me from the park for 90 days.
Why not just leave for 90 days? You know, 3 months isn't that long a time for the risk, you know, given the risk.
You don't love rock climbing, obviously. I mean, that is a long time, and it's too long of a time. If you're used to climbing every day, that's not an option. So what I did is I packed up my tent, and there's a giant boulder field behind Camp 4, and I went up into the boulder field, and I lived up in the boulder field where I was out of sight, out of mind. I still climbed every day. I just had to be very careful to not be seen. Also, you know, a lot of times I was up on a big wall. So, you know, that's a place where rangers can't find you.
Dale came out of hiding to climb and to hang out with friends at camp at night. It was on one of these nights, when Dale and some buddies were sitting around at their picnic table, that their friends Frank and Arnold rolled back into camp, visibly excited about something.
Frank and Arnold, they came in and they said, my God, you won't believe what we found.
By now, there were probably 20 or 30 climbers that lived in Camp 4. And when they heard the commotion, a crowd gathered to see what was going on. Frank told the story.
He had just taken a short tour out to this lake with a friend of his, and they were skiing back, and they looked out on the lake, and this is like early spring, so the lake is basically what is termed as candling, and meaning it's thawing out. And they saw this tail of an airplane sticking up out of the lake. The first impression was that, God, we've got to let somebody know. they also started going, man, there's probably bodies. So they started looking around, and they didn't see any bodies, but in the waters, this big thing pops up, and it's a burlap bale. And so they shimmied out there and hooked the bale with a ski pole, drug it over the ice, and got it to a safe spot, and realized what it was, opened it up, and just went, oh, marijuana, pot.
Inside that burlap sack, they saw the treasure they had never even known to dream of. They saw their ticket to many more years of elective unemployment.
Then they looked out on the melting part of the lake and saw multiple bales. So they came back to camp and they told everybody and they said, man, there's stuff out there. And everybody had dollar signs in their eyes at that point. Hank and Stefan said, let's go. They got up the next morning, and when they came back and there was visible proof that this was real, it was a what do they call it? A run on the bank. Like everybody and his mother were grabbing whatever pack they could have and marching into the lake. Bring packs out, bust up the bales, and take as much as they could as they could carry and bring it back in.
Over the course of the next few weeks, they got more and more efficient at extracting the weed, pulling it out assembly line style. They hiked out with chainsaws that they stole from the Park Service. One guy would cut a square of ice, the next guy would pull the ice out, the third would fish for the bales. This lake in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere, was suddenly crowded with climbers and their friends stuffing their packs with as much pot as they could possibly carry. But Dale wasn't with them. Driving the main road out to the trailhead was too risky. He might be seen in one of the cars.
And so I opted to not go to the lake.
But this didn't stop Dale from getting in on the action.
My job was to dry the pot because I could do that in the boulders.
He'd been hiding from the rangers in that boulder field for weeks, so he also knew exactly where to hide the weed.
The downside to the pot was that it had to be dried because the plane crashed, and so there was jet fuel in the water. The first couple pounds that we dried out, we didn't dry it out enough. And when you rolled yourself a joint, it was like spontaneous combustion when you put a flame to the joint. It was just called airplane weed. If you knew it was airplane weed, you knew it was tainted with jet fuel. My job was pretty simple, although I will say that every once in a while I got a little bit nauseous from the fumes because you had to rake it and stir it. And imagine 900 square feet of marijuana that you're raking and the jet fuel fumes are coming off.
Once Dale was done drying it, the pot was then transported to LA and San Francisco to be sold. It took about a month to clear the lake of all the pot they could find.
Later, we figured that a bale was probably 50 pounds dry. After all was said and done, we retrieved over 200 bales of pot. 200 bales at 50 pounds a bale. Whip out your calculator.
By the end of the run, Dale estimates they moved 10,000 pounds. Or 5 tons of marijuana.
Climbers that truly needed some financial, you know, sustenance, so to speak, they got it. I mean, some guys bought brand new cars, some guys bought homes. I didn't make very much, but it was enough for me to live very comfortably for, you know, 4 or 5 years. By the time the Park Service found out about it, everything was gone.
When the Park Service recovered the plane once the ice melted, they didn't find much pot, but they did find 2 bodies. This story might sound kind of hard to believe, but there is actually photographic evidence. One photo is of a huge burlap sack with dark brown leaves in it. Another is of some guys chainsawing through the ice. Yet another is of some climbers wearing full backpacks, grinning from ear to ear. They look young and fit and happy.
I guess the biggest frosting on the cake, because of the LEO section of the Park Service, was touche, we got the weed, you don't even know who got the weed, you can only guess who got the weed, and we got the money and you guys got sandbagged.
There were 50, maybe even over 100 people going up to the lake that spring. So we figured it couldn't be that hard to find someone that had gone up to the lake. The people we did talk to, most of them now in their 50s and 60s, some of them with grandkids, they all fondly remember those carefree days where all they had to do was climb and dumpster dive. And of course, they all remember the lake full of pot. But when you ask them if they were there at the lake stuffing their packs full of it, a wry smile spreads across their face, and a glimmer is in their eyes. Nope, they say, definitely not me.
Big thanks to Dale for that story. And for the protection of the people involved in this piece, pseudonyms were used. I want to personally thank, though, Cisco DeVries, who, as we walked through Yosemite Valley a while back, he told me this story, a story that his father, Papa Tom DeVries, had worked on as a reporter many years ago. Thanks also to all the climbers that helped us, and a big, huge thanks to the filmmakers, Greg Laut and Nicholas Rosen from Cinder Films. Check out a link to their amazing documentary on this very story, Valley Uprising. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original score and sound design for that piece was by Leon Morimoto, and it was produced by Julia DeWitt and Anna Sussman. When Snap Judgment returns, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Well, at least we'll have one of the three. And the biggest roller in the universe, when the Snap Judgment Crash and Burn episode continues, stay tuned. This Snap Judgment podcast is supported by Next Issue. Because snappers, we want to feed our minds with the best of what's out there. But no one has time to sift through all the nonsense on the internet. Solution? If you want premium content and don't want to waste time finding it, there is Next Issue. Next Issue is a mobile app that lets you plug directly into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. I'm talking iconic magazines like National Geographic, Outside, The New Yorker. Sign up for Next Issue right now. Get immediate access to all the top magazines, including back issues and exclusive videos and photos. Mark, you know I like those yoga magazines, right? Because I'm trying to get my mind right. The best part is that Next Issue is issuing a free trial right now when you go to nextissue.com/snap. Again, try Next Issue for free right now when you go to nextissue.com/snap.
Hey, thanks for listening to Snap. Summer's ending and there's so much good music in the air. The All Songs Considered podcast is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best, new and upcoming music. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Crash and Burn episode. Today, we're exploring what happens when something bangs up against something else. Now, I'm going to warn against doing anything done in this piece, but I especially would like to warn brown people. There are some things we just can't do. Parents,
Illegal substances are deployed in this story. Legal substances are deployed to ill effect as well. Snap judgment.
My wife and I had gone to our marriage counselor, and we had a tradition of going out to dinner after each of our weekly therapy sessions. On this particular occasion, we had taken two cars to the therapist's office, and I left in a huff before she did, and I drove straight home, locked and chained the front door so she would not have access, barricaded myself in the garage, and proceeded to snort an entire 8-ball of cocaine within a matter of minutes. And when she got home, I emerged naked and dripping with sweat and somehow persuaded my wife to go forward with our usual tradition of going out to dinner in spite of my state. We went to Beverly Hills to the Carnegie Deli. When we sat down, I wanted desperately to come down from the coke. So I excused myself to go to the men's room. And on the way, I found our server. I slipped her a $50 bill and asked her to prepare a tall glass of scotch upon my exit from the men's room and to not let my wife see this. So when I came out of the men's room, there was not just a glass of scotch, it was a 12-ounce water glass filled to the brim with scotch. I downed the whole thing, managed to somehow make it back to the table, banging into things, etc. And as I sat down, I went into what can only be described as a blackout. I stood up and started shouting at the elderly couple at the table next to us. I grabbed her strawberry milkshake and poured it down her blouse, and then began to run around the restaurant, grabbing patrons' dishes and entrees and flinging them across the room like so many frisbees. I'm told that I then very angrily threw a $100 bill down on the floor and stormed out of the restaurant. At this point, my recollection begins to come back to me. I'm walking up Beverly Drive with the remote clicker to our car, clicking left and right, trying to hear a beep to locate our car, since I don't remember where we parked it. And I come upon a valet parking lot. They happen to have an SUV, very much like ours, the same dark green color, motor running, and the driver's side door open. The valet says to me, "Your car, sir?" I said, "Well, yeah." And as I attempt to climb into the car, I fall back out and land on my butt with a thud. And does this prevent the valet from helping me into the car? No. In fact, he picks me up physically, lifts me into the driver's seat, and I'm on my way. I drive out of the lot onto Beverly Drive, and at this very moment, I see two Beverly Hills squad cars coming right towards me. They immediately recognize me because I'm wearing a red beret and a bushy goatee, which no doubt had been described by the restaurant manager when she called the cops because I was disturbing the peace. So they immediately flip on their lights and sirens. I took this as my cue to jam down on the gas. I turn right onto Brighton Way. Now, Brighton Way in downtown Beverly Hills is a one-way street. And I am going the wrong way. And then, all of a sudden, two more squad cars join the chase. One from the left, one from the right. A police helicopter swoops down, and I have the big beam of light on the hood of the stolen car that I'm driving. I get to the east end of the Platinum Triangle. Two more squad cars, now a total of six, are chasing me up and down through the primary downtown business district of Beverly Hills. The only thing I'm thinking as all of these cars are chasing me is I need to get away. It is pure fright and flight. I'm driving as fast as I can, not only weaving between the cars, but jumping up on the curbs, driving on the sidewalk. I flip the car in one last desperate move, 180 degrees, to attempt an escape. But the vehicle flips onto its roof. Hanging upside down, but still belted into my seat, I see now in front of me a semicircle of 10 Beverly Hills police officers. Their service pistols all pointed straight at my head. There's a fire engine in the background, an ambulance. The helicopter is still making circles around, and a crowd of nearly 200 people has assembled. Having the whole windshield crash in on me, the helicopter, the crowd, the fire engine, the ambulance, and 10 cops with their guns all pointed at me, it kind of shocks you into a different state. It was like, oh, this is real. This is actually happening. This is not just a joke like the rest of my life had become. This is real. You're about to be dead. The act of surrender that no doubt saved my life was to push my hands forward, fingers spread as wide as possible through that broken out windshield, and to very clearly, calmly, and slowly announce, 10 fingers, no gun. At this point, the cops, guns still pointed straight at my head and my heart, slowly converged in on me, and I was handcuffed and taken away. And now when you put cocaine and alcohol together, it forms a new metabolite, a third chemical called cocaethylene. My levels of cocaethylene were lethal. I was taken to the Beverly Hills jail and put into the drunk tank with about 20 men. The cells at the Beverly Hills jail are immaculate. They have porcelain toilets, they're not steel. The people are nice. But I was not in a stable frame of mind, to say the least, and I tried to drown myself in the toilet. This did not amuse them at all. And so I was transported, shackled at both the ankles and wrists, and I ended up spending 5 days and nights in my suicide watch solitary confinement cell, which, by the way, does not have a nice pillow and mattress. They give you a rubber blanket, which cannot be made into a noose. And they watch you continuously. They keep the temperature so cold that there's no thought of rebellion. All the inmates in that unit stay huddled under their rubber blankets, searching for whatever warmth they can find. On the fourth day, I was told I had a visitor. The visitor was my wife and an attorney, a very fancy pants lady, high powered attorney, who announced to me immediately with a big cheerful grin. She said, "Good news! I've got the four felonies, driving under the influence, evading police, under the influence of cocaine, and grand theft auto. I've had them all reduced to misdemeanors." Now, it's still four counts, but I think that's really good news. Ultimately, I was released on condition that I would be checked in the same day to the Cedars-Sinai Chemical Dependency Unit. My wife brought me home. We packed a bag. I was taken to the hospital and checked in. And that turned out to be 30 of the most enjoyable, sunny, and fun-filled days of my life. Everyone there was a cokehead, a junkie, or a pill freak. I felt right at home. At the end of my 30 days, I was taken to see Judge Eldon Fox at the Beverly Hills Courthouse. Judge Fox was and remains judge to the stars. He was the judge for Lindsay Lohan, Winona Ryder. He gave me a lot of credit for having completed the 30 days in rehab at Cedars. And the prosecuting attorney, who was a lady, cut a deal in the ladies' room with my fancy pants attorney, and they agreed together to drop all the charges except one, misdemeanor DUI. I was sentenced to the 5 days I had already served in the county jail, given summary probation, and released on my own recognizance. A week later, my attorney came to discuss payment of her $10,000 fee. She looked around my living room and admired one of my paintings. I'm an artist. I had my paintings and photographs all around the house. She particularly liked this one oil painting, and she asked if she could take that painting with her in lieu of her fee. Believe it or not, this is true. That painting hangs today between a Picasso etching on the right and a Jackson Pollock piece, a lithograph, on the left in her private collection in New York. All I can say is there's no accounting for some people's taste.
Nice. It must be real nice. I'm telling you, crash up the place. Just lose a few days and a painting? Again, be sure not to be black if you try this. And please, do not try this. We here at Snap Judgment, we want to live vicariously sometimes. Big thanks to Jupiter Diego for sharing his story. And big thanks as well to Whit Mistledean, the creator of the This Is Actually Happening podcast, a part of the Misfit Radio Network, which is where we learned of this story. Discover more about that podcast, find them on your podcast catcher, or visit snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Whit Mistledean with an original score by Renzo Gorio. When Snap Judgment, the Crash and Burn episode continues, someone may or may not have their hand in the cookie jar, and it is a really big cookie jar. Stay tuned.
Support for this podcast comes from TNT with Public Morals, a new series set in 1960s New York. Here is creator Edward Burns describing the Public Morals Division.
These cops work in public morals, and public morals is what typically would be called today the vice division. Back then, they referred to these crimes as victimless crimes. Primarily, it dealt with gambling, prostitution, and anything to do with alcohol and the blue laws.
Watch Public Morals series premiere Tuesday, August 25th at 10, 9 central, only on TNT.
Hey, thanks for listening to Snap. Summer's almost over, and there's so much good music in the air. The All Songs Considered podcast is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music, and lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
From PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment. My name is Glenn Washington. You're listening to the Crash and Burn episode. Today, we're exploring what happens when you make the big bet. And our next guest, at a very early age, had his heart set on making some of the biggest bets of all.
I used to work with this guy. He was an option trader. No emotion whatsoever. He would sit there, he would have his hands on the desk, he would look like the Sphinx, right? And he would just take staggeringly huge amounts of risk. You'd never know if he was losing money, you'd never know if he was making money. But that was not me. You always knew if I was making money or losing money. It was written all over my face.
It was the early 2000s. Jared was a trader who sat on the second floor of Lehman Brothers.
You know, when I tell people that it was nothing short of a miracle that I got that job, it really was a miracle.
Jared didn't go to an Ivy League school. He didn't have a posh upbringing. Basically, he had no connections to Wall Street, but he worked his butt off for 2 years. And here he was at 25 on the trading floor, where $400,000 can be lost in a matter of seconds. Jared's job was to play defense and limit those kinds of losses.
Every day was like going to war. It was like going into battle. I really felt like putting on a helmet. That's what it was like. There was one trade in particular. I mean, it wasn't even a big trade.
Jared bought 100,000 shares from this one client that had a bad habit of selling to different banks at the same time, making the price of the stock drop instantly.
So we lost $50,000. I'm, you know, pounding the desk and I'm yelling over at the sales guys. I mean, I'm combative. I'm furious. You know, I'm sick of dealing with these jerks. You know, I said to the guy sitting next to me, the guy that I worked with, I said, I'm not hedging this trade. I refuse to lose money in this trade. So I bought 500,000 shares of QQQ, which is the NASDAQ 100 ETF. Now I have two positions, which collectively are about 5 or 6 times the size, that are both going down at the same time. If you're losing money on a trade, you just close out the position, you take the loss, and you just move on. That's what a disciplined trader does. You know, I was doing something not only that was undisciplined, but was extremely reckless, just so I could make the money back. Just out of anger, you know, just an irrational anger. It worked.
The risky move paid off. The market went up, and Jared broke even.
I think I said to myself at the time, I don't think I want to do that again. But I used to do those kinds of things all the time, just to keep from losing money. I was a very emotional trader. You know, I would do all this crazy stuff at work, and then I would come home and make a cocktail and sit and watch TV. And that was my life. I was living in a house that was, it was in New Jersey, and it was not in a great area that was pretty cheap. And I wasn't spending money on clothes or food. You know, anytime I got paid a bonus, I saved the whole thing. You know, growing up, I just had to do without a lot of stuff. Very different from most of the folks that I work with. Very different. People made fun of me all the time. I would literally bring a can of beans to work, and I would have a can opener, and I would open the can of beans and eat it with a plastic fork, and that would be my lunch, 49 cents. You know, they said that I was crazy. And sometimes they were complimentary. Sometimes they would say, like, genius or something like that. But, like, this crazy, smart ETF trader. And then the clients would say, well, why don't you bring him out to dinner? They're like, no, we don't think that's a good idea. We don't let him out. We don't let him outside. For me, it was really about, it was about winning. I mean, look, like, I knew that I, you know, screamed and yelled way more than anyone else, lost my temper, took massive amounts of risk. Something would go wrong, and I would lose a lot of money, and then I would pound on the desk, and my computers wouldn't work, which would make me even madder.
One day, a coworker asked Jared to close a huge deal. He wanted Jared to buy 400 NASDAQ futures. The stock market was already closed, so making such a huge trade was going to be tough.
It was a big order, but I thought I could do it, and I didn't want to look bad. I didn't want to be embarrassed. I mean, this is what I'm good at, right? I'm good at trading futures, so I wanted to, I wanted to do it right. So I immediately get on the phone, and I call Chicago Mercantile Exchange. I call the clerk, this guy. I'm almost halfway through, and then all of a sudden, the guys on the floor, they're not trading with me anymore. They won't sell me anymore. They keep moving their price higher and higher. You know, I was getting squeezed by the floor traders in Chicago, and my colleagues were yelling at me on the other end. Are we done? Are we done? Are we done?
Jared felt like he was in the middle of crossfire. The clock was literally ticking, and he wasn't making any headway.
I mean, I was just stuck. I couldn't get the trade done. I had a physiological reaction. It was almost like I couldn't hear, like I couldn't see. It was just rage. I just flipped out. I just picked up the phone and I slammed it as hard as I could on the desk. It exploded. I mean, it absolutely just shattered into a million pieces. And the whole floor just went silent. There was probably about 150 people on the trading floor at that moment. The market had just closed, and so it was very quiet when I smashed the phone, so everybody could hear it perfectly. I get the sense that everybody's looking at me, and then I just started to walk off the floor.
It was so quiet, Jared could hear his own footsteps. Then without even thinking,
I do like this fist pump in the air, and the whole place goes nuts. I get like this standing ovation. One of the funnier traders on the cash desk, he yells out, he says, never too late in the day to break. I was actually smiling by the time I walked off the floor.
To Jared's surprise, he didn't get in trouble. Not for walking away from the trade, not for breaking the phone. In fact, that grandiose outburst got him promoted to run the ETF trading desk.
It was a big deal. I was very happy about it. It was a big job, and I knew I could do it. I knew I could do a good job, but my behavior was erratic enough. I knew that something was wrong because nobody else acted this way.
Then one day, Jared got an email from a compliance officer at Lehman Brothers.
They identified like one or two very tiny trades. I mean, like tiny trades, like 65 shares of some stock that I had traded like 8 months before, and they wanted more information on it. You know, I mean, look, like in my job, I mean, I make tens of thousands of trades a day. I can't possibly remember all of them. So I'm, you know, racking my brain like, what did I do? What did I do wrong? What's going on here? You know, I got a hold of the compliance officer. I'm like, I don't even remember this. And he says, 49 times out of 50, you know, I fill out the paperwork and we just never hear anything again. And I said to him, well, what about the 50th time? My brain just went into like paranoid overdrive.
The high stress of the job was getting to Jared at his core. There were days he couldn't get out of bed, and the days he could, it'd take him an hour just to leave the house.
I started, you know, thinking that people were watching me. I believed that I had done something criminal, and the New York Stock Exchange had hired the FBI to come after me, and they were following me, and so I started to see, like, guys in suits looking at me. I lost weight. I mean, I lost an incredible amount of weight. I lost over 40 pounds. I was just living in this, you know, this fear, this terror all the time. People were concerned. People told me that they were concerned. You know, someone's like, you just look terrible. You know, is everything okay? This had been going on for a couple of months, and I was at work, and there was a Fed meeting, you know, where they decide interest rates. And I always traded around the Fed meeting. And it means the market gets really volatile, so I always made money. And for some reason on this Fed meeting, I bought a huge amount of futures, and the market went down.
He was down $500,000. Definitely not the first time he was down by this much. But on this day, it felt different.
Somehow, like, my brain told me that I had something to worry about. I was paralyzed. And basically, like, I was paralyzed with fear about this whole FBI thing. Like, I thought I was being watched, and I couldn't get out of the trade. I couldn't sell it. I just looked up a random psychiatrist, got out of my desk, and I just started walking across town. I knew something was wrong. You know, I get to the psychiatrist's office. It's like on 55th Street on the other side of town. I throw myself on the couch in the waiting room, and I'm just shaking and crying. And of course, they bring me right in, and, you know, she starts asking me questions. You know, she says, are you depressed? And I'm like, yes. And she says, well, have you felt good recently? And I said, absolutely. And she says, you need to go to the hospital. I was happy. I was like, great. I ended up in the psych emergency room. I'd never seen one of these before. I didn't know what was going to happen. They took my clothes and all that kind of stuff. And one of the other patients, I introduced myself to him, and, you know, I asked him what he was in there for, and he said, well, you know, I was super depressed, and, you know, I ate a bunch of pills and blah, blah, blah. And he says, what are you in here for? I said, well, I'm not crazy. I'm here to get away from the FBI. I believed that agents would come to the hospital and demand my release, and the hospital would refuse or something like that, but they weren't going to let me out, and I was at least going to be able to buy some time in the hospital. That was like my plan. It was really real. It was really real. It sounds crazy in retrospect, but, I mean, this is what I believed. I think I might have slept an entire day, like 24 hours. I just slept and slept and slept and slept. You know, when I woke up, I sort of figure out that, you know, I'm in a psychiatric ward, and I don't know how long I'm going to be there. So it was a little spooky for a while. Like, I was like, man, am I stuck here? This is actually worse than I thought. In the meantime, you know, like, once I started being medicated, like, all the, you know, all these delusions that I had about being followed just went away. They just seemed preposterous.
Jared spent 3 weeks in the psychiatric ward and learned that he has bipolar disorder. But when he left, he didn't think twice about going back to Lehman Brothers.
The guy who was head of equities, you know, I bumped into him the day I came back to work and, you know, gave me a big handshake, you know, pat on the shoulder, you know, get back in there. It was very hard because I had to learn how to trade all over again. You know, I'd be staring at my screens and I'd sort of watch, you know, the prices flickering around, and I'd be like, you know, watching my screens, and it just felt like everything was moving in slow motion. And, you know, honestly, in the beginning, I was like, I don't know how I can do this. Over the course of a couple of months, what actually happened was I was a much better trader on medication than I was without. Much, much better.
But even though he was a better trader, he realized it wasn't enough.
Instead of, you know, being about the center of attention and all this glory and being like the stud ETF trader and all that kind of stuff, just my priorities changed. I didn't want that anymore. I mean, what I wanted before, I didn't want anymore.
So at that time, what did you want?
You know, I just kind of wanted some peace and quiet, actually.
But now would not be the time. The year was 2008, and Wall Street was about to crumble.
I knew that there was a housing bubble. I knew that it was massive. I didn't know the extent to which the banks were at risk.
It was becoming very clear that most banks wouldn't come out from under the financial crisis unscathed. Lehman Brothers was on the verge of going bankrupt.
for most people, the bankruptcy was really scary. I wanted to walk away clean. I wanted Lehman to go bankrupt. The bankruptcy was sort of a nice exclamation point. You know, it gives me an excuse to get out of there. You know, management was trying to put deals together all the way up until the very end, trying to find somebody to buy Lehman. I was really rooting against the deal.
Finally, the day arrived when the verdict of Lehman's future would be handed down.
I could see from a couple blocks away that there was TV trucks lined up all around the building. There are reporters shoving microphones in your face and stuff like that. So you get inside and everybody's like, you know, they're hiding. And I just kind of waited for, like, you know, the final news that, you know, we were bankrupt and that was it. The CEO of Barclays at the time, this guy named Bob Diamond, he came down to the trading floor. They gave him a microphone and he announced that we were going to get bought. Yeah! You want to talk about a standing ovation. I mean, the place was going nuts. People were going crazy. They were so happy they were going to get to keep their jobs. I was the only one who was not happy on the trading floor. I was not happy. It was really hard. I had a lot of people in my ear telling me what an idiot I was because everybody got to keep their jobs. A lot of people got retention bonuses, and I turned all that stuff down. I literally could not do one more ETF trade. I had just gotten my head caved in so many times over the years. I just took off my tie. I just walked away. I was absolutely done.
Thank you, Jarrett Dillian, for sharing your story. Now, Jarrett still keeps tabs on Wall Street, but now from a safe distance. He has a financial newsletter, The Daily Dirt Nap, and a book, Street Freak. We'll have links on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original soundscape for that piece was created by Renzo Gorio and was produced by Nancy Lopez. About that time, Snappers. But you say, give me more. Give me more stories. Well, I've got what you need. Do not fear. Subscribe to the Snap Podcast. Never miss a beat. Full episodes, pictures, movies, stuff available right now at snapjudgment.org. And at Snap on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Snap was produced by myself and the team that always takes one for the team. Spin around for the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Beat Popper, Pat Massini Miller, Anna Lightning Sussman, Julia Thunder DeWitt, Hurricane Nancy Lopez, Joe the Tornado Rosenberg, Renzo the Tidal Wave Gorio, Davey the Ice Storm Kim, Reign of Destruction by Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein and Leon Morimoto, Matt the Windstorm Ducat, April Showers, of course, provided by Jasmine Aguilera. Now, did you ever strip down to your drawers and do push-ups in the lobby of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? Well, it turns out they've hired security since the last time we tried that, but much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, always wins those push-up contests. I think it's because of the shiny lotion. WBEZ in Chicago doesn't need no stinking lotion. Hear me? And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could build a secret room in your secret house and hide secret experiments in it. And when someone knocked on the door, you could scream, "It's upstairs! It's upstairs!" And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.